are trapped in linguistic constructs. All that is metaphor.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like this.
I believe that the truth of the matter is far more terrifying. That the real truth that dare not speak itself is that no one is in control.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain.
There's something wrong.
I am this one and only. It's what there is and all there is, and you are really good. You are really good. You are really good. You are really good. You are really good.
Linda kasi tiny ma ora ya moya moy ni nai na nai na nai nai dai da dai da dai dai di dai da dai da dai dai di Linda sa lo se toy ni dai da dai da dai 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 ora me dise nai ni senari ri dai da dai dai da dai
Will, I have one more question for you. Give me like a quick one word answer. So all these films that have made before, if your film that you made just now is this accurate, what are the implications for all the other sync films that have been made and all the other sync films that are going to come? The implications that this is, there's really something to this.
Groundbreaking. One word answer?
Yeah, awesome, awesome.
Well, Robbie had a rough night the other night at the 8121. Out all night having fun, he rose from bed with the ringing in his head. The clock struck one, the room filled with sun, and he got up to wash his face. And he said, "What's wrong with the mirror? I'm not looking so great." He said, "What's wrong?"
I don't know. To me, I just feel like Andras said, that this is the next step as far as the sync films. It's not like all the sync films before this are invalid or anything, but there's like, I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but there's kind of a weird thing that happens with sync films. It's like you want to see a new one, and then you see it, and then you're like, oh, God, that was great. But then you never want to fucking watch it again. It's like the high is done or whatever. And
oh, that's not true for me. I actually watched your Man in the Mirror again yesterday. I still really, really enjoy that film. And I'll go back and every now and then I go back and watch old sync films. I really think they really, it's almost like Andre said, it's almost like the context gets added. You know, I can watch an old, you know, Kotze or Wilner film, and even if I've seen it four times before, there's something now that, you know, the context has been added, now that there's 10 years added on to the research or the event. You know, if you say watching an old Kotze 9/11 video, suddenly you have the context of 10 more years of history to go, wow, it really played out that way, or not, you know, but just to get that extra impact.
I just feel that this brings more use to the whole the whole art of what we're doing. I mean, when you interact with the actor, or the actual artist who did this stuff, it not only is it repurposing for them, like Andras has said, but it's useful. I mean, there's something to it. There's an excitement on both sides. It seems like it's the next step, or it's what we've been striving to do the whole time. I don't know why someone had not thought about doing Andras before, but probably because, you know, there's a stigmata around people think they know who Andras Jones is before they fucking have actually met him.
That was a nice Freudian slip there, stigmata around Andras. Isn't that essentially how both you probably meant stigma, but stigmata is, you know, that religious, like, bleeding from the hands and feet, which is basically how both the prom and Attic Expedition ends, is with Andras and stigmata.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And this is that third rail of sync that I keep trying to bring up and no one ever wants to talk about, which is the whole Jewish question, is why is there such a focus on Jews? And that is, I mean, in a Christian country where the mythology is all about crucifying the Jew to save the town, basically, save the world, save everyone's souls, that is a subconscious urge that will come up over and over again. And it just feels right to crucify the Jew in all kinds of weird little ways. So it's interesting, again, Freudian slip. Stigmata. Speaking of Freudian slips, do any of you get the funny, dirty joke in the middle of Will's film with the phone call with the woman who called in and asked about my dad?
I know what you're talking about. What's the joke there?
I'm just curious. Before I bring it up, did either of you pick up on, like, there's a huge Freudian slip right in the middle of a picture of Freud? You guys, I love that nobody hears it, because to me it's pornographic. Okay, I say, so if you were in class at that time, then you probably did it. I mean, we're in class with my dad.
Oh, wait, you're right.
And my dad, like, definitely, you know, that was one of the things. That was the 70s. Professors had sex with their students in the 70s.
Right.
And it was like a thing in my family, you know.
And this is Jung having sex with his...
Right.
Patience.
And that you picked that, like, I've heard that, but then you put it over, it's the ultimate Freudian slip. we're talking about Freud, it's the Freudian father, and I, you know, because I just assume that he's had sex with all of his students, because that's the way a kid sees it, if, you know. Anyway, that was just, I think that's one of the whole, that to me, that's the funniest thing in the film.
Hey, can I take this in a personal direction? You said the idea of that, you know, you assume as a kid that's the way you see it. You know, there's this idea that your father is known as somewhat of a, you know, a womanizer, or you know, certainly if you're growing up with your mother, that's what you're hearing from her perspective. But then there's also this sort of idea of sexual prowess or accomplishment, how do you want to phrase that? But this idea that as a kid you say, I assumed you slept with all of them. You know, growing up in a similar sort of situation of being raised by my mother, but hearing stories of my father's infidelities and sort of pervasive sexual actions, you sort of grow up with this really interesting sort of interplay of both the idea that you have to sort of rise to that level of sexual prowess, but also that it's, you know, that sort of conflict there. Does that speak to you at all? I'm asking on a personal level, if you're interested in a personal.
Yeah,
question.
No, I honestly don't know. I mean, that I wouldn't phrase it that way. If there's, I mean, I always think of things, and my family's the dynamic was that my dad was, you know, he was a psychologist. Although I don't think he had a reputation as being a womanizer. I just knew that, like, he was a guy who listened really well and was sort of a lot quieter than me. And I think attracted and was also a great professor. And he attracted a lot of the attentions of his students. And so I guess I aspire to that, to being attractive in that way. But that's not but then the negative things about my dad were, there are different negative stories I heard from my mom, who was probably more of a masculine figure in my life. You know, in terms of holding authority and being, you know, hypercritical so it's a totally different cocktail than you're talking about.
And I guess that's why Will is able to pick up on this very strong, almost motherly, but sometimes violent anima figure in your life.
In the films, definitely.
In the films, yeah.
I guess
I'm making the assumption that that carries over into your life.
It does. That's one I'm still trying to figure out. It's easier for me to understand the other stuff. The appearance of the redhead and although this conversation is helping me to make a little bit more sense of it. I'm sorry, I'm not very verbal because the impact of that has just, I need to let that sit. I'm still trying to figure out what to make of it. I don't know if you both read my blog, but with this film and with it coming out on my birthday, I am using it for all the magic I can to try and initiate the next phase of my life. And a lot of that means, this is me vomiting. Someone should interrupt me at this point.
Oh man, that's one of the first things that I asked when I was talking to Andras on the phone. Like, yeah, I can put something together, and he was sending me movies that I couldn't find and so forth. I just wanted other actors. I just want to continue doing this, because it's a very pleasant experience for me. I mean, I was already doing it. I would already get inklings about certain themes or whatever, and then I would kind of watch every movie that I could that involved with those subjects or an actor or whatever. But then there's such a time limitation on what you can do and what you can put out. And so there's so many projects that I have investigated and not been able to actually produce or put out or write post on or so forth and so on. And this just it was very focusing as far as attention and energy goes. I just want more actors. I just want to do it again. And I don't think for one minute that everybody's going to come out as personally relevant as Andras is. Perhaps they will, but I mean, I really had the opportunity of call Andras and say, you know, what's up with your mom? When did your mom and dad divorce? What was your relationship with your mom? You know, different things like that were of a necessity. Although I have to admit, when I first started the video, I didn't know where it was going to go. Like, I had no idea why the fuck Leonardo DiCaprio was creeping up in it. All of a sudden I discovered that Freddy Krueger was in a Leonardo DiCaprio movie, and I'm like, oh, that's the connection. But that happened.
And Andras is a Leo also.
Right, right. They both share similar themes and concepts, and then his name is Leo, Andras is a Leo, and both of them have to do with this conflict with the anima, which in my opinion has to do with the strength card, or the lust card in the Crowley deck, which is overseen by the constellation of Leo. Perhaps, I don't know if you could, but there's a theory, I guess, that probably actors have a certain trend with the tarot or a certain tarot card. Say Jim Carrey's the Fool card, Andras would be the Beast card or the Beauty and the Beast or Strength card.
You know, but it's not that actors do. Everyone does. It's just actors are we take pictures of and put them in archetypal situations that we all focus a lot of attention on. Every one of us probably resonates, you know, has an archetype that we resonate most strongly with. And the sort of purpose of a lot of these initiatory or magical practices is to explore all of the other ones and fill up so that ultimately, although you may be, you know, you may have one card at the center of your tree that you're able to move into any of the other archetypes. And maybe that's also something that an actor aspires to and other people don't.
Yeah. You know, Will, I mentioned before your previous film was called Man in the Mirror and is all about that strength card.
Right.
And I actually, having watched it yesterday, I think it sort of,
well, you know what Jeff Bridges, you know what Jeff Bridges' middle name is, Alan?
What's that?
Leon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I think that film is a nice sort of tangent to this one in the sense that with Andras, what are we noticing? You know, the idea of the mirror and this sort of anima in the mirror or this conflict in the mirror, and your previous film dealt with the interplay of was more from the woman's perspective with her sort of animus in the mirror. You know, she was seeing, you know, Belle sees the beast in the mirror and things like that. These films almost work as a nice sort of mirror to each other.
I actually can see that taking place in Isis Incognito, which I don't have up on my Vimeo account, but it's on YouTube and it's been re-released on YouTube, so they will actually let people watch it now. It's the copyright infringement has been taken down, but it dealt with all these different actresses like Ellen Page and so forth and so on and their connection to Isis. So there's definitely a continuation. I mean, there's a theme in my own work that I'm sure somebody could analyze if they wanted to. I think the biggest thing is that you take, like Andras's shit career, you take it and you watch it with the understanding that nothing anybody does is useless. No work that you do or anybody else is just throwaway crap work. This whole idea, I can't stand it when I'm trying to talk about. Now, I was trying to talk to somebody about Andras's sink. Like, it's like, well, you might know him from Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and they're like, oh, that was a shit movie. Like, that was the worst movie. Like, all of a sudden, the conversation is not even worth happening because they don't like the fucking movie. And what I hope this film does, the psychosomatic analysis does, is, like, open up people's eyes to the fact that it's not the movie that's shit. It's your opinion of the movie that's shit. And we have to redefine the way, and our opinion of the world is shit. Our opinion of conspiracy theories or what we convince ourselves, or what a lot of people have convinced themselves of the person Andras Jones is. This is an incorrect definition. Well, what is necessary is to redefine.
I thought you were saying to keep the maybe language. So maybe the movie is still shit, but you can find the gold within it.
Well, yeah, that's the alchemist's game is to transform. We transform things with our vision. That's why, like, there are great works of art and there are shit works of art. But if I sat, you know, the idea is that any one of us could sit down with a great filmmaker and watch a shit film and have a great conversation about that shit film.
Yeah.
That's inspired, that's informed not by just the opinion, you know, wanting to elevate yourself by saying it's shit, but by people who are like, it's funny that we're using scatological language because, again, that's part of the matrix. We don't accept what we create. We flush it down the toilet and take no responsibility for it. You know, and that even that's reflected in our language. So rather, I was going to say, like, we could watch a film that is poorly made, poorly cast, poorly directed, that didn't make sense in its time, that was marketed, you know, that anything that was good about it was marketed out or in the wrong way, any of these things. But if you sit down with Martin Scorsese, who isn't, you know, two directors who are in your film, who you don't credit at all, by the way, but Cronenberg and Scorsese are shot through this whole thing. So sit down with Cronenberg or Scorsese and watch any poorly made film, you could have a great conversation if they wanted to, because the context that they bring is one that they're looking at the shot and being like, oh yeah, I know why that failed.
I would absolutely adore to show this film to Scorsese, because Scorsese's obviously influenced by psychology. I mean, if you ever watch Departed as not with what the movie is about, but what the subtext of the movie is. I mean, Leo's girlfriend in that, they call her Miss Freud. The whole movie is about psychology. You can take all the headshots and the friggin' people getting shot directly in their fucking forehead over and over and over again. It's just an analogy for head cases or whatever.
Or ego death.
It's crazy. It's crazy because, and then he did Shutter Island too, which was all about psychology. I mean, I don't know.
And then if you go to Cronenberg with The Dangerous Method, obviously, but if you look at A History of Violence, which I don't know if you've seen, but with Viggo, great film, where he's a guy who has this nice family and everything's great, and it's sort of like a Born Identity kind of thing, except he was a bad guy. But his history of violence comes back to haunt him, and he has to deal with it. And again, it's a very much a psychological analogy for the subconscious. Both of those directors are, obviously, all of Cronenberg's horror films are hugely psychological. It's so funny. I read an interview with him where he was saying before Dangerous Method, he'd never really paid much attention to psychoanalysis or psychology, and I just couldn't believe it. I thought he has to be kidding.
Well, see, you have to figure
what he's experiencing right now is once he realized – I mean, this is an argument I was trying to make in my Sync Book chapter, is there's a point where you're making the things – you're making the artwork unaware – and at some point, you realize, oh my God, this is what I've been doing? And it's like, you were already doing it. You were doing it unintentionally, and then you just turn around and go, holy shit, I've been doing that. That's what I've been doing. So I got to figure for Cronenberg, he was, at this point, after making Dangerous Method, he has to look back on his previous films with a brand new set of eyes.
Yeah.
Doug just mentioned the whole concept of psychosomatic and psychocinematic, which is really interesting, Andres. Do you mind telling them the story of what happened to you after the prom, after you derobe and have all these blotches on you?
Yeah, well, I had my dad had this weird sort of skin discoloration thing that I had never got, and then after that film I started to get it, and for like the next 5 years, I dealt with having these itchy red splotches on my body that required me to like radically change my diet and do all these things that ultimately were good for me. It was nothing I had struggled with until after that film.
Huh.
So the film, but it was something that was latent probably in me, but that film again accidentally initiated me into something that had physical manifestations.
Doug, would you read your psychosomatic?
Well, when Will was talking about the film, he was saying psychosomatic analysis, and it's just the way he was pronouncing it. Did you do that on purpose, Will?
No, not really. I mean, I think that I had realized that psychosomatic was close to psychosomatic. I knew what psychosomatic. I mean, psychosomatic, attic insane. I knew what psychosomatic illness was, but that was completely unintentional. However, when you mentioned it, because me and Andras had talked about – Andras and I had a lot of conversations, drunk and otherwise, while we were making this film. And so when I would get an inkling about something, I would call him and ask him questions about it, and he told me that story, which I thought was very interesting, because I guarantee you there's a whole bunch of times – an actor's career where what happens in their films end up happening to them in real life, or there'll be some connection between the two. That particular story by Andras, though, I think is really important.
Yeah, and then I from the writing perspective, I've been tracking for a number of years before I even got into Sync, but this is what really why Sync so interested me, I think, was that I had been paying attention to this idea of writers who noticed that what they were writing would end up happening. And it was this idea of, you know, it's almost that Jeffrey Kripal idea of authorization, but an unintentional variation of it, where the stories you're writing are actually playing out in your life.
So that, speaking to that and what you guys were talking about, this next phase of Sync filmmaking, this is interesting because it seemed like with the first phase, it was the realization phase where we would turn the camera itself and see the paranormal that we're creating. And now it's almost like repurposing and reauthorizing. You know, it's the last two phases that Kripal was talking about. So it's not merely the realization that we're writing ourselves, but it's also the reauthorization of the material. So, you know, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I can completely understand what you're saying.
That we're going to be the authors of the...
Redeveloping the story. It's kind of weird, though, because I'm a little bit nervous. Like, if I ever wrote a story and I identified with the character, do I not put the character in any fucking painful situation? And I don't know if it was on... It was on something. I can't remember what we were talking about. I think it was – I was listening to a podcast by Kripal, and he was talking about the whole association of car accident. You can't reduce the out-of-body experience or the religious experience that one experiences like when they have a car crash, because maybe the car crash was a necessity of the religious experience. So do you do that to yourself? Do you authorize yourself to have these terrible experiences so that you will grow?
Well, isn't that kind of, that's why, you know, it seems to be that's why the, you know, love and light idea of everything being perfect, unless you accept that everything is kind of perfect already, that even with the suffering, that suffering, you know, this is something we could debate philosophically, but I'm saying, unless you want to come at it from that perspective, that the suffering is necessary for the joy. But I think when we've talked about the idea of people wanting to avoid any kind of suffering or even talking about suffering seems, you know, Doug has mentioned many times you have to go through into room 237. You have to have the dark night of the soul. Otherwise, you don't get, you know, you have to go through hell before you get to heaven type deal. Or do you have to? But it certainly seems that way. And, you know, instead of having this attitude of there's not a goddamn thing in room 237, it's like we don't want to talk about it, but it's actually a really necessary part of life.
Jung, if we invoke him again, I like the idea of actualization. So you are becoming the youest you possible, and so you are on your path, and then if room 237 is what it takes, then I guess that's what it takes.
Will's gone, but you know, Will had mentioned he was just starting to read your book, Andras, and I'm curious, you know, obviously having worked on the book, I know when I watch that film, what I see certainly like, is it William Morgan Shepherd is his name?
Yeah.
I see, it's really interesting that Will, our Will, picked up on William Morgan Shepherd's connection to you, which you speak about in your book, and things like that. I was wondering if you would speak at all to the idea that he picked up on a lot of things, again, what not only what's personal synchronicities for you, but that he picked up on things that you sort of highlighted, and that things that, you know, obviously are important to you, that you thought when writing your book, these, you know, these are the things you chose to highlight, and Will seemingly unknowingly or very knowingly in this other sense was able to also pick up on those things. I was wondering if you'd speak to that.
Well, first of all, when he started the project, I wanted him to read my book. And what's also interesting, well, I'll say I wanted him to read my book. And I kept, like, he kept saying things that were like, oh, have you read it yet? He's like, seriously, man, stop bugging me. I'll read your book when I get to it. And I was like, okay, wait, actually, if you keep getting it right and you haven't read my book, actually change that. You can't read my book. Please don't read my book until it's done. Because you're already lining up with it, so it's better that you do it blind. It makes it more honest and more synchy for me. So on that level, it was really interesting. On another level, that he really highlighted something that only you as the editor of the book, and it's funny that we all refer to it as the book, which is what it's referred to, how it's referred to in the Attic Expeditions, where my character has penned this magical book. The book is called Accidental Initiations in the Kabbalistic Tree of Olympia, or just Accidental Initiations, or just AI, for those who are interested. And there's a follow-up blog called AI Accidental Initiations 2, which is the blog that follows what happens once the book is released. But one thing that only you would know, Alan, is that initially the foreword to the book was a picture of this crate, of a treasure chest that was on the cover of the Olympia Film Festival's movie program. And the movie theater that came from plays a role in my book. And then that Will focuses on a movie theater and then has me getting trapped in this chest in the Attic Expeditions, which is a metaphor for the brain. And we took that synchronicity out. We took the synchronicity of that cover of that magazine out of the book. But for me, it was really what I realized at the end of the book, was that I was somehow trapped in that loop, in that case, in that head case that the film created, and that we did all kinds of interesting and but not very grounded or conscious magical ritual around. And that I, you know, that Will's film, he really does release me from that loop. It's very interesting. And that he, you know, and yeah, it's,
no, that is very interesting. You're seeing it as I guess being aware that you're in the loop is what frees you, you know, sort of that knowing is half the battle type deal, or I don't know how you want to put
Well,
that,
no, but... I don't think that's it. I think that knowing the book, finishing Accidental Initiations got me to the point where I knew that I was in the loop.
Mm.
And that created a certain kind of consciousness. And you saw, you know, and that had all kinds of ramifications. That loop being recognized by the film, that is the other piece. There's the self-recognition, but then having someone else recognize it and, you know, not recognize it in a sort of passing way, but to actually stop and unlock that so that other people can get it. That's what sets you free from the loop or from the trap. You know, it's weird. It is sort of this weird, like I'm casting myself as Sleeping Beauty, right? The prince has to come along, and or maybe I'm casting myself as the frog. Okay, yeah, I'll make Will the pretty girl who has to come along and kiss the frog. But it's always that, like at some point you realize you're the frog or you're stuck as asleep, and then you have to wait for someone to come along and be human with you and get it and unlock that thing in order for that story to play out. In this case, because my book deals with honor among men, it makes great sense that it was a fellow sink traveler, a fellow explorer of these, you know, of these terrains to come along and recognize it and, you know, take my hand and pull me out of the box so that now really he, so that now I can be his ally in going forward and creating this new level of sync films. I mean, what he's done is he's taken me out of the box and said that he's, that I'm the psychologist of sync. I mean, that's my legacy here is, and that what I need to do is create the kind of containers. And these films are the containers for doing this with exactly the people who could get it, which is that if Will and I are starting to connect with other actors who are on the periphery, who would benefit from this kind of analysis, you know, they have Will, who's a, you know, a very excited fan. And then they have me, who's someone who knows exactly what their experience is and can, and also bring to it whatever psychological mojo that I've inherited that makes it easy for me to push people's buttons or in the right context, you know, help them see something about themselves that is awesome.
But for the record, I think Will is demonstrating, I'm sure you would agree with this, I just want to sort of tack this on to your statement there. You said Will is a, you know, very excited fan, but he's also a fucking genius when it comes to noticing what to zero in on.
He's a total scholar of film. I don't mean that. I just mean that. I guess what I mean is that Will has a fantastic view of the outside of film. Mm-hmm. In a way that gives him insight to the inside that he doesn't really even understand yet. And I have a lot of experience, like the people that you're making films with, that's the next level of what we were talking about, and I don't want to go into it too much because we're still developing it, but the idea would be to make these sync films as kind of a segment, a part of the Radio 8 Ball show, where we do it like a quick little exploration that involves an introduction, a sync film, and then ideally a quick little interview with the person and getting their response, you know, to what this experience is. And if we nailed them in a good way, not nailed them in a bad way.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know. There's something about that that's really exciting. So again, it's just, one of the things that's great about Will is he is the most unlikely of scholars, which is, I think that's, and in a group like the Sync group, which is, that's pretty much all of us.
Oh yeah. We're all, yeah, this is a bunch of misfits that suddenly found themselves with a realization.
Monkeys who got the internet, man. That's all we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that's true, but I think there's a lot of people with the internet. And most
actually, people, there's a book that just came up this past weekend, and it tickles me because it plays so nice with what you guys developed in this film. It's called The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. And the book starts with the thousand monkey theory. And they actually tried the thousand monkey theory, and they just found the macaques like the letter S. They didn't get any works of Shakespeare yet. So we are monkeys with the internet, but there's something particular to us that is causing this strangely psychological exploration. I was So during was you were talking with Will, I was noticing that your father and you and you're both Joneses, and so there is a bit of Indiana Jones here, where instead of the Steven Spielberg, we're going out and discovering the secrets. This is more we're going in, but it's the same. It's the same story.
Well, I mean, and that is what I mean. All of those films are, even though in the film is about them going out, it really does, especially at the end, you get that it's all about going in. It's a head trip. That's what film is. So yeah. Yeah. And I resonate a lot.
There's the archaeologist angle, which goes back to the idea of the, you know, the added years of context where time actually creates a sense of depth when you're going out and digging up the past. It's essentially the same thing.
The Ark of the Covenant and all those initiation. It starts with his initiation through one weird little labyrinth, and it ends with another one, except this, at the last one, he has to do it with his father. Or to save his father. It's, yeah. Yeah.
Right. It's Freud and atonement and psychology. Like finishing the job that his father started it's psychology.
I was the other man. Sorry. That's my Sean Connery. Because, you know, that, I mean, again, and we're going back to what you were talking about before is like you have this hypersexual, distant father who's doing great things. And yeah, that, you know, you aspire to that. You become Indiana Jones. Fighting Nazis. That's why I'm here in the realm of Sync, by the way, to fight Nazis.
Yeah, you and me both.
That's where I figured, oh, this is awesome. It's the coolest place to fight Nazis is in the realm of Sync, because it attracts the conspiracy-minded and some of the conspiracy-minded in this country and in this world and this time are going to be caught up in the, you know, their projection onto Jews, just like it's weird projections onto homosexuals, making them into the conspirators.
It's the shadow thing.
I think people don't like their shadow.
Michael's piece in the Sync book always is just so stunning to me because, you know, he's saying we're repressing this component of ourselves, and of course is exploding everywhere there's no conspiracy, it's what's happening by trying to contain your shadow.
What you resist persists. Simple as that, man. It's like a law of the universe.
Now, well, I just play devil's advocate here. So how do you fight Nazis in that situation?
Well, first of all, sense of humor. You can't, like, you got, like, when you're dealing with Nazis, you got to have a sense of humor. But the other thing is you also have to be completely willing to, you know, Nazis play life or death games. So, you know, if you have a sense of humor in that realm, it's got to be a killer sense of humor. One that ultimately, I mean, it's just, you got to be able to call it on what it is.
I guess my point was for that guy who thinks, you know, I have a very specific scenario, a real life scenario I'm picturing in my head, but I'm just, my thing here is to take the guy who thinks it's all some homosexual Illuminati Jewish conspiracy to make you a gay Jewish Illuminist or some, you know, whatever the bizarre theory is. So it's easy to see that is shadow projection, where that guy is basically putting out his fears and projecting them to the world as the villain. My question is, then when we see the villainy of a controlling behavior like that, or not say like that, say something more explicit, where do you say, do you ever draw the line of what's shadow projection? So, you know, hey, there's you know, someone committing genocide or something's happening. Is that shadow projection? Is that, or
no? That's a real. That's a real. I mean, there's a.
Okay. So, like I said, just playing devil's advocate. Where do you draw the line for the guy who says, "No, there really is a gay Jewish conspiracy. It's real."
Well, I would just okay. Well, first of all, I mean, it's just so silly.
I know it's silly.
But what I would say is, if they use, like, what I would say to say to you is, like, the analogy is silly. Like, there's a genocide going on. There are bodies piling up, and there are people. There's something that is currently happening. What is currently happening is, yeah, okay, then of course. And then let's really deal with, like, be critical thinkers about trying to figure out how, like, how things got that way and if we have any agency at all to affect that. There's a whole other thing that doesn't have any, that, like, the idea of Jewish conspiracies or gay conspiracies or, I mean, of course, every group conspires on some level to protect itself, and the more oppressed that group is, the more likely that they're going to be, quote, conspiring to have each other's backs to protect, you know, to, like, support each other and make sure they don't get, you know, that there's someone, you know, they're supporting each other in some way. Although, because there's very little thinking around that, those groups are just as likely to be set against themselves and each other than to actually support themselves or each other. And the idea that any one of those groups is really marginal in the broad context, financially, in the corporate structure, that they're responsible for some conspiracy just is an example of a failure of thinking and getting caught in what I would say is the real conspiracy, which is the us or them conspiracy, the conspiracy that there needs to be a scapegoat, that someone's got to be at fault and someone's got to be the scapegoat. So that
someone's got to carry the shadow projection.
Yeah. And it's funny my book of my father's that I think is the most interesting and the one I'd love to make a movie of. It has a horrible title. It's called An Application of Psychoanalysis to Education. An Application of Psychoanalysis to Education. And it was his doctoral thesis. And the experiment was, if students didn't know they were in a psychoanalytical setting, if they just were taking a class on psychology, during that class, they experienced what group psychoanalysis, the container that creates, would their perceptions, and they before they would take a test about their, that would test their level of prejudice, and at the end they would take a test that would test their level of prejudice, but they weren't told that it was testing their level of prejudice. It was just a questionnaire to fill out before you could take the class, and when you filled out it again at the end of the class. And the hypothesis was that without knowing it, people would become more tolerant by being a part of a psychoanalytical experience, even if they didn't know that's what they were doing. That this would happen in a way that you could demonstrate. But what's really interesting is that he documents going in, and they're all girls. Classes. He's going girls' schools in the Northeast in 1960, basically, or maybe 59, 58. They are all people who want to do a psychology course. And the psychology course starts with, okay, well, we need to set some boundaries. And if you agree to these, then we can go forward with the course. And then the conversation about the agreements starts, and my dad sits there and is a psychologist and eventually and insists that they that every level of agreement or disagreement gets dealt with on that level, and the girls start projecting madly onto him, like they're angry at him, they fight with him, they try and flirt to get, you know, and he documents all of the ways that these young students are projecting onto him, and he's just sort of being a difficult psychologist in a way of just saying, well, what does that mean to you? Which drives them crazy. And this projection, You know, that's the, you know, that's what I think we all miss, is that in the absence of someone doing that consciously, we cast people to do that in our lives unconsciously. Everyone as someone that we're treating like these girls treated my dad in this class, except that he was a professor and he had all kinds of protections and it didn't get to him because he knew what was going on. But I guarantee, Doug, someone at work is doing that to you, or you were doing that to somebody else, or, you know,
Alan's doing it a different way too, though. It's like children and parents. And as children,
we all make somebody that ended up bad parent.
But there's this hope, or not hope, this belief as a child that your parents have everything under control. And the idea of the garden, you know, you're in the garden, everything makes perfect sense and you're taken care of. And then you get a little bit older and you realize your parents don't have a clue what's going on. I think there's that projection from people on they create this conspiracy because they still want to live in a world where someone's at least in control. Mm-hmm. Even if the childish belief that someone's running this thing, it's not just, it can't be
this fucking crazy.
I mean, there's got to be someone at the controls of the machine, right? It's not just going.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
And we all hold a piece of the wheel.
Sure. That's the thing. The realization that you are the one that is actually driving the machine, and that if you want to have any influence in your world, you're going to actually have to drive the machine.
Yeah.
Whatever that means for you. And I'm trying to figure it out for me.
And even if you're not, then I think what all of us are clicking on to is that even when we don't know that we are, we are.
Yes.
Even when we're making our mistakes, we are. And that, I think that's, I mean, bringing it back, like you can't have that attitude. I think, to me, I don't think you can have that attitude and really be sink. I think a lot of conspiracy minded, Nazi minded people are attracted to this because they like the excitement of the chase in the synchronicity, like looking for the villain, looking for who's in control and what you're talking about. But to me, I almost think that's a non-sync conversation. I think it's the anti-sync. It's the shadow of sync. And again, that maybe I'm just projecting onto that. And anyone who wants to have the conversation that keeps elevating that way, I'm totally game to look at, you know, to look at my, you know, look at my projections. But at the point when it becomes, well, clearly you are a part of, like if I'm talking to a Nazi, you know, I guess they're not really National Socialists who are on this, who are involved in SYNC. It's people who are convinced that Jews are evil or are part of the Jewish
conspiracy. Jason refers to them as Nazis, NOTSEE, someone who doesn't see.
Right. Or all they see, like, they always see the villain under the villain under the bed. And to me, it's no different than people who just like, exactly like Doug is saying, it's childish. And it's not, to me, it's not sync. It's like, the essence of sync is a sense of humor. And if you don't have, to me, everything that is sub-humor is not really sync. As far as I'm concerned, and those are the conversations I'm interested in having. In a way, is like, that's my conversation with Pinchbeck. That's my conversation with, you know, go on and on. We can draw the, you know, I don't want to out anyone who's part of our community, who's not already on the larger stage and putting themselves out there that way. But that is the ultimate conversation I'm trying to have. Have a sense of humor. That's what Olympia, the cunt who lives in my left shoulder, keeps saying.
You know, it's funny that you keep coming back to this sense of humor. I mean, I think we're all sort of having this play out in different ways. That's how it works for you. And I think that's probably a really healthy way of looking at it, is to be able to laugh about it. But I think, like, I'm finding a sort of personal conflict where I'm, by engaging this community, like, I'm sort of engaging both the conspiracy community and the sync community, and I'm finding that my effort to try and get them to see a little bit of the other side, if they are the sort of, you know, you said pure conspiracy is the anti-sync. Well, I think of it as sort of like yin and yang, you know, where it's like there is a little bit of sync in the conspiracy and there's a little bit of conspiracy in the sync, which is fine. You know, that's how it should be. But to get them to try and understand at least a little bit of that. So I guess my thing is, you know, I'll go on a conspiracy show and I try and make the point of like, okay, yes, you know, there are actual conspiracies. There is, you know, if you're upset that the International Monetary Fund basically took, you know, seized control of the, you know, political seats in this, you know, in Indonesia or something, you know, hey, that happened. Yeah, that's fucked up. Let's talk about that. But when you want to talk about, you just start connecting all these dots and going, oh, this is proof that this guy once walked down the street, the same street as this guy. And then, okay, that connects to this and this and this and this and this. And then you sort of spiral in your mind of this huge, you know, vast thing that obviously there's some Mr. Burns at the top that's pulling all the strings is where I get like kind of frustrated. And to try and show people that, no, it's not like that. There is this other phenomenon at play here. And then I go over to the sync community and everyone goes, oh, everything's just wonderful. It's just joy. It's just like everything is fucking great and everything is just so perfect. And my thing is, well, yeah, the universe is incredibly beautiful. In the long run, I have faith everything works out and all these sort of things. But, you know, that guy over there is fucking, you know, doing this horrible thing and maybe we should stop him or talk about what that means for us or, you know, to say that there's some suffering in the world and where does that play into this? And people don't want to see that either. It's like if you just ignore it, then it'll go away. And for me right now, I'm trying to engage both sides of this. And it's something that I feel fairly comfortable for myself, having found a balance to say that there is this middle ground, sounding like a middle ground, just to say that both are true to an extent. Again, to an extent, and not to say that, but I want to be very careful. It's not that I think when I say both are true, it's to say conspiracy is true. It's not to say I'm agreeing with the, you know, douchebags who think that there's a, you know, gay Jewish conspiracy. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about actual...
That there, you know, I think what we're getting to is that there is an important conversation to be had about specific conspiracies. There are specific conspiracies.
Yeah.
There are specific things that we can look at and deconstruct and say there is something at play here that is not sync. It's not the fact that any connection can be made to anything that is going on here. No, someone clearly aligned these things to affect a certain result. And did they get the result and how did they do it? And we can be detectives and figure that out. And that's a very valid conversation.
Yeah.
Sync is a conversation that happens on top of that. It's almost like if you're going to do that, then you also like sync is the psychological aspect of it. It's like on some level that's going to show up in the rest of your life. And you have to know the difference between the people who shot Kennedy and your dad.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And sync is the level where you're like, oh, yeah, in my dreams, my dad killed Kennedy. Oh, what does that say about me and my father and blah, 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 blah. And being able to have that conversation and see how that shows up in culture and in the movies and the music you listen to and all these other things, that's really valuable. But if you go into the realm of conspiracy without knowing the difference, without doing the sync work, then you can become a humorless, you know, kind of a humorless sociopath who's just on the trail of, who's chasing a synchronicity, who's chasing their father, who's chasing their own shadow down the rabbit hole, instead of actually being a detective and thinking critically and presenting a good case to other people, saying, you know, this is not about me and this is not about conspiracy. It is about what happened.
Yeah, and really I think that takes away. So this is why I was saying, I think that takes a certain level of maturity to reach that point. That, and I guess adding humor to, you know, like your thing was, you need a good sense of humor, and I was trying to say, I think you need some level of maturity of like, let's not be children here that think everything's this scary monster under the bed. But let's not be children either that think everything's puppy dogs and rainbows. So what if we can understand that things are a little more complicated than either of those two positions want to make out. And then you want to say, and once you reach that point, you better have a good fucking sense of humor. Then I agree with you.
Yeah. But I think, and I think what it takes to get, I mean, I just know for myself, if I am getting there, what's made it possible is having a sense of humor. I mean, to me, a sense of humor and a sense of sync and a sense of rhythm are all the same sense. You know, it's just, it's being able to be in the interplay. Like, you're not just passively receiving life and you're not enforcing your will on life. You are part of life, recognizing it and dancing with it and responding to it with everything that you bring, you know, that you bring as a human and your spirit and your ancestors and everything that's led to this moment of sync that is rhythm, humor, you know.
Yeah.
It's sync.
I am in love with a whore. She is the one I adore. I am in love with an actual, genuine whore. The sacred kind. She'll blow your mind by way of your cock, and then she'll blow your cock by way of your mind. She's the sacred kind. When sacred prostitution swept across the states, all the new age rich boys started getting dates. When sacred prostitution swept across my home, left me feeling full inside, though outwardly I was very much alone. The sacred kind. She's the sacred kind. When sacred prostitution swept across the land, the third through fifth wave feminists had things well in hand. A sacred prostitution swept across my life, burned away some ego, liberated my potential wife, the sacred kind. Whoa, liberated her from me, and that's a tough pill to swallow, brother, 'cause I love her, the sacred kind. Oh, the sacred kind. Oh, sacred kind.